Thanks for tuning in to Greater LA, KCRW's show that connects you to the people and the places of Southern California. I'm Erin Arby Kaplan, in for Steve Chiatakis. Clothing, food, gasoline. It seems like everywhere you look, prices for everyday things keep going up. Inflation is up nearly 7% in the U.S., the highest increase since the early 1980s. When wholesale prices increase, business owners typically pass the higher costs on to their customers. But if your regulars work at the bottom of the wage scale, you can't really raise prices that much before your customers just decide to keep their cash in their wallets. Today on GLA, we'll hear from some merchants who are paying more themselves while trying to limit the impact those price increases have on their low-wage customers. KCRW's Benjamin Gottlieb brings us the economics of the taco truck.
Elizabeth Garcia runs a little breakfast and lunch stand in Boyle Heights. It's called La Patrona, or the boss, and it's hidden among an expanse of warehouses just north of the 6th Street Bridge. A colorfully decorated trailer attached to a silver GMC pickup truck. This is not the type of place you stumble across. You know it's here if you work here, in one of the warehouses or driving trucks, and that's about it.
Yo soy originaria de Puebla. Pues los guisados son, digamos, que el sazón de mi abuelita, que ella es la que me pasó el gusto por la cocina.
I'm originally from Puebla, Mexico, Garcia says, and let's just say the guisados or stews are my grandmother's. She's the one that gave me this taste for cooking. Garcia does some special stuff here all by herself, but that doesn't necessarily mean that business has been good. She's making less money than before, she says, because of how expensive things have become at the supermarket. A good example, she says, is the price of onions.
Pues, por decir, la cebolla es uno de los principales ingredientes aquí en mi cocina.
Onions are one of the main ingredients of my cooking, Garcia says. Months ago, I was getting a bag of onions for $14 to $16, depending on the quality. Right now, it's $24 to $27. If she was going to entirely offset that cost, she'd have to raise prices by a lot. She tried that for a bit, but it didn't go so well.
Reducían sus pedidos o también algunos ya no estaban viniendo. Entonces, yo tuve que volver a dejar mis precios como estaban.
They cut back on orders, Garcia says, or some stopped coming altogether. So I had to put my prices back where they were. For now, she's settled on $2.25 for a taco. It used to be just $2. Garcia has also raised her burrito prices by 50 cents. But she says to actually cover her increase in costs, she'd have to raise those prices by a dollar.
Tienen también su sueldo mínimo, entonces eso también pues es un impacto para ellos el comprar su comida.
Many of my customers also make minimum wage, she says, so this is impacting their ability to buy food, too. Garcia says she's constantly hunting for better prices. She shops at Restaurant Depot, or if that's too expensive, she wakes up early to hit the fruit and vegetable vendors near MacArthur Park. Her experience with these rising prices mimics what many other small business owners are going through, says Karina Guzman.
A lot of them are absorbing the cost, are absorbing it themselves. So they're extremely, afraid and hesitant to lose any customer.
Guzman works with the community development organization Inclusive Action for the City, which, among other things, supports LA's street vendors. One of the ways the group does this is through microloans, as high as $30,000 apiece. Demand for these loans has never been higher, Guzman says, as inflation rises and vendors feel uncomfortable increasing prices too much. For Garcia, it's onions. But for Juan Ariola, who runs a carpentry business about 10 minutes east of Garcia's food cart, it's plywood.
Que me costaba $37 en ese momento, ahora está en $67.
Doble, más o menos.
Más o menos, casi el doble. O sea, $30 más.
A sheet of plywood that used to cost $37 now runs him double. Ariola uses that plywood to build cabinets.
Hacemos todo tipo de gabinetes. De baño, de cocina, entertainment center, cualquier tipo de gabinete y también cuando nos
cabinets for your bathrooms, your kitchen, your TV room, anything you want, he says. And when they ask for furniture, tables, chairs, doors, we do it.
De cualquier tipo como mesas, sillas, puertas, también los hacemos.
Here's how he says inflation is affecting him and his business.
Me impactó negativamente. Muy, muy negativamente porque cuando
it's really affected me negatively, Ariola says, very, very negatively. And a big part of that comes down to the price I've quoted clients for, say, a cabinet, and now how much that costs me to make. I'm working off some quotes that are 6 months old, he says. But the price of materials has more than doubled in some cases, and so I have to either eat the cost or risk losing my clients. Ariola says he couldn't have paid his power bill this month if it wasn't for a $20,000 loan from the nonprofit Inclusive Action. He says, I don't know how I would have managed to keep working without it.
Yo no sé cómo le hubiera hecho para seguir trabajando.
Many small business owners have survived the pandemic so far thanks to loans like the one Ariola got. But the more low-interest money out there, the more inflation goes up. And at some point, something's got to give. And for small business owners like these, it's a difference between making a living and closing up shop. In Boyle Heights, for KCRW, I'm Benjamin Gottlieb.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
It's Greater LA on KCRW, and I'm Erin Aubrey Kaplan. For more than 40 years, Reverend Donald Wilson worked as a hotel chef in Los Angeles, mainly at the Century Plaza Hotel. He remembers a time when there were more Black workers in the industry, but then there was a shift. Wilson says the industry started discriminating against Black workers and hiring them less. He took on the issue firsthand. For 15 years, he served as the organizing director of the diversity program at the Hotel Workers Union Unite Here. He's now the founder of the Black Hospitality Workers, working to provide training and support for current Black hospitality workers and for those looking to enter the industry. Reverend Wilson, welcome to Greater LA.
Thank you for having me this morning. It's a pleasure to be a part of this program.
So let's start with the main question. Why are there fewer Black workers in the hospitality industry in 2021 versus in the past?
Well, first of all, the excuse that the hospitality industry would give is that African-Americans do not come in and apply, but I can bring you a busload of African-Americans who want to work in this industry. But I got into the industry in 74, and there was no question about where are the African-Americans, because we were in those jobs and had those jobs, and it was very well diverse. And around 1980 is when we started disappearing from the hospitality industry, as I recall. I started at the Century Plaza Hotel in 78. And when I got there, there was no question African-Americans working everywhere along with everybody else, Latinos and Caucasians and a good diverse group of people.
What happened in 1980? You know, what was the turning point?
Well, I think I don't think he had anything to do with it, but the former president, Ronald Reagan, when he busted the air traffic controllers.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And it was at that time, either African-Americans started quitting or started getting fired, and management collaborated together to really bring in an influx of the Latino population of workers, even though they were already there, but they took advantage and shift. And so as opposed to having African-Americans with them, sometimes they would resist because the name of the game is high profit with low labor costs. So if you get one person to do two or three people's job and get by with it, that's what they like, you know? And I saw that shift coming about, but as an African-American, if you push us to the limit, our civil rights blood will start boiling in us and we will resist. But what took place, we were able to gather up Latinos as they were hiring them and organize them through labor, Unite Here, Local 11. And so we were able to train them and get them to stand. So we started fighting back.
You started working specifically on increasing diversity, that is hiring more Black workers, almost 15 years ago, 10 years ago?
Right.
What progress has been made in that time? I mean, you're not doing that anymore, but how did that work?
There was some progress made because we negotiated a contract back in 2004, I believe it was. We negotiated a contract which has the most powerful language that spells out of hiring African-Americans back into the industry. And the workforce was willing to strike for that language to have it in there. And the hospitality knew that they were wrong in doing us the way they did us. And so they agreed to it by us applying pressure. So there's no other language that I know of in the nation that we have in Los Angeles. Well, we did it in four of the cities: Los Angeles, Boston, LA, and San Francisco. But LA was the most severe. And this language here spells out hiring African-Americans back into the industry, which calls for a task force.
Mm-hmm.
That was the key to that language that consisted of hotel operators, the union, and the African-American community. And the key puzzle to that was an ombudsman. And when you had that intact, it was to bring accountability and sustainability. And we would meet every month to make sure that that was taking place. And periodically, once a month, they were supposed to send us records of who was interviewed, who got hired, who did not get hired. So that took place for 15 years, but that was not all the way put together to my satisfaction. I have to be honest. But if they had to put all the puzzles together, then it would have been working pretty good. But it did put a little dent. But still, if you walk to these hotels, you can still see there's still a big issue, and the hospitality industry knows that.
And then after that, you left that position and you started the Black Hospitality Workers Organization, the BHW, and mm-hmm. You had something called the BHW Boot Camp. Tell us how that's working differently.
Let me explain that. It's not a BHW Boot Camp. When we first got the language in 2005, we did a boot camp. But that was not under the BHW. The boot camp was intact with the union contract.
Okay.
So the boot camp was very successful. And what it was, we did, I started to work in 2005 of October. We did our first boot camp in November 2009. And what that boot camp consisted of was a 1 week, 8 hours a day, 5 days a week at a union hotel. And what we did, we recruited over 80 African-Americans and interviewed them for 25 slots. And so we only took 25 in. And then at the end of the week, we would have a graduation, and the general managers from the various union hotels would come in to the graduation, and they would just about hire you on the spot. So we did like about four of those. And we had some African-Americans that would hire into the industry that way and still have those jobs. And then that evolved, the boot camp evolved into the HTA, the Hospitality Training Academy, which is the training arm of the union. The BHW, I organized that after June 2020 when I was, we had a mandatory, but we had a layoff because the pandemic slammed our industry. I worked for the International Union, and they put an offer on the table that I could not refuse. And I took the offer off the table for an early retirement. So I tried to sit still, Aaron, after 1 month, June 2020. I organized, God gave me a vision to organize the BHW, Black Hospitality Workers. And so that came into form. And so I've been doing that and getting it off the ground slowly but surely in my retirement, couldn't sit still. And so that's what's happening right now. And the purpose of that is that I'm focusing on the current workers that we have in the hospitality working now, African-Americans. Then I'm also focusing on the new ones who will come into the industry that's never worked in this industry. And that's the key right there, because they have no idea of what they're going to run into when they come into this industry. And one of the purposes of the BHW, Black Hospitality Workers, is to prepare them mentally.
Mm-hmm. You have emphasized these are good paying jobs with opportunities for career advancement. For a lot of Black people, they resist that. They say we need to aspire higher, that this is the kind of work we've done in the past and we need to move on. What do you say to that? And what is the interest like amongst Black people who might be part of this, this movement in the country to turn away from service jobs?
Well, they don't see them as career ladder jobs. And as I say, there's enough African-Americans, if they are educated in that field and their service sector job, their physical jobs, but they're good paying jobs that pay with dignity. If you came into that industry, you'll find that it's very exciting because we have people now coming out of other careers wanting to get into the hospitality industry and especially culinary.
Well, locally, according to the LA Times, hotel bookings in the fall were up to pre-pandemic levels, which is a good sign for what you're trying to do. So is there a shortage of workers, specifically Black workers, to keep up with that demand?
There is right now, I believe, because of the fact that we have to educate our people and I need to be exposed to all types of groups where there's a huge African-American following that don't see these as career ladder jobs, and they can be. You can find your niche. And I've been in the industry so long, like for instance, during the boot camp, in 1 week, I'm looking at people, 25 African-Americans, male and female. By the end of the week, we have a pretty good idea of where we need to start them in the industry, level entry positions and stuff. And some of them started in skill positions because they had some customer service experience, you know. And not everybody's cut out for the front desk. Then you got some people who may work in the back of the house. They call it the back of the house, behind the scenes. But not everybody's cut out for this and that. So you'll find your niche. And everybody cannot cook or have the tolerance to cook. But then there's other areas that you can filter into.
Reverend Donald Wilson, founder of the Black Hospitality Workers, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Okay, Aaron. Appreciate it.
Back now with Greater LA. I'm Aaron Aubrey Kaplan. Rising COVID cases and fears over the new Omicron variant are making many Americans anxious about this holiday season. But despite those fears, there are plenty of Angelenos gearing up to head home to see loved ones. It's been a long 2021. And for some, this will be the first holiday that they've been able to gather with friends and family since March 2020. KCRW's Danielle Chiriguayo brings us the story of three Angelenos who are making the journey home. First, you'll hear from Kate Waffle, who's visiting family in the north of England. Then from Ariana Jordan, who's heading back east to Chicago. And finally, from Alexander Schaefer, who is seeing his family in Germany.
My name is Kate Waffle. I live in Hermosa Beach, and I am headed home to the UK. I'll be landing in London and then going up to the north of England to a place called Sheffield. Normally, I go home every Christmas. I've lived out in LA for about 4 years now, and I go home every Christmas because Christmas in California doesn't feel that Christmassy to me. It's too sunny, it's too warm, like I'm used to snow and all that stuff. I mean, there's worse places to be trapped. A lot happens in 2 years, so I feel like I've missed a lot. My parents usually come out twice a year. I have a brother he would normally visit. I missed a couple of weddings, a couple of cousins and friends having babies. So when I get back, I will be meeting some new husbands, some new babies, new family members. People that I'm friends with have lost people. My friend's father passed away, another friend's brother passed away, and you know, I'm sending them messages and I'm being available for phone calls and sending flowers, but you know, it's not the same as actually being there and going and sitting and having a cup of tea with someone and checking they're okay. It's just, it's been difficult. I'm just excited to be at home and seeing my parents, and they're acting as if I'm a tourist. They've got all these like plans and stuff. I'm like, you know, it's just like coming home for me. Like, I know where the best food is, and I know about this park or this castle or whatever you're trying to get me to go look at. Like, they're planning it as if, like, I'm coming on a vacation to somewhere I've never been before just because it's been so long. And I just know that it's because they're excited and they're trying to, like, kick off all the things off the list that they think I'll have missed. And I'm just really excited to see people in person. And obviously, because it's England, I'm excited to, like, go to the pub with friends and I've really missed the food, and everybody's like, oh, English food, really? But I love it. If you're born and raised on it, I'm just so excited to have some like fish and chips and a pie. every time I go home, the first thing I do is, because the planes always land, you always kind of get a night flight. They land in the morning, so it takes me then from London a couple hours to get up to where my parents live. And the first thing I do is, on the way back from the airport, we stop and get fish and chips and take them to the house. Because even though you do fish and chips here now, it is not the same. So that's the first thing I do every time we go and get fish and chips. And that's my first meal when I get home. We're simply having a wonderful Christmas time.
Simply having a wonderful Christmas time. I'm Ariana Jordan, and I'm originally from the south side of Chicago, Illinois, but I currently reside in downtown LA. So because I'm new to LA, I've only been here for a year, I was kind of going back and forth home a lot. And now I'm trying to kind of break that pattern so I can make LA my home now, officially. The other day I was thinking about, like, when I first got on the plane, and I think the first thing I thought about was my grandmother, who I call my sweet lady. And I was like, I can't believe I'm moving away from this person. So I'm just very excited to just sit with her and be there with her and just hear her talk about what's going on with it on the news. So I think that is the person I'm going back home for. No, don't tell my nephews that, but it's my grandma for sure, my sweet lady. I'm in this stage of my life where I'm just like, I need to start thinking about what I want my family to look like. Not that I'm trying to even have kids, but I want to be a person that is really into the holiday stuff. Like, I want to, like, do the gingerbread houses, have the tree and all this stuff. I do have nieces and nephews, and so I'm just like kind of going home and I'm being this very festive auntie. So I'm looking forward to just seeing the excitement on these little faces and their smiles, and just, you know, I really do have a gift of just bringing people together, and I do consider myself the best auntie ever. So I'm looking forward to just really seeing my niece, my nephews, my grandmother again, my sweet lady. Like, you know, I think we do the typical, maybe build the tree together. I love watching my mom decorate the house and her buy new pillows or whatnot. So yeah, when I get home, I'm gonna basically make them get into tradition. And I'm like, we're gonna watch the Polar Express, we're gonna do the gingerbread house, we're dressing up the same pajamas, like, we're gonna do the whole nine.
I think that when I think of home, I mean, I think of, like, my father, for example, smoking a cigar with them, right? Like on a balcony, or, you know, just hugging my mother on the stairs, right? She's like much smaller than I am. And so she always like gets on the steps so I can hug her actually, right? Like, so. I'm Alexander Schaefer. I'm 35 years old. I'm currently living in LA in Playa del Rey. And I'm going back to Germany. I mean, I moved here to LA like 2 years ago. So it was like, you know, 3 months before the pandemic, like, was, you know, right on time. And yeah, I haven't seen my family since. I feel like what I always was, like, you know, this type of guy who I think like can be alone really well. But in this year that like really got tested and like pushed to a limit, that I really kind of felt a degree of isolation, also like a physical kind of, you know, isolation, that it pushed me through the limit. And I really felt like in some kind of moments, like really, really lonely, right? Like when I was sitting in my apartment, right? Like, as I said, like earthquake happening, pandemic is there, like yellow air, right? I'm hearing the riots and I'm asking myself, why am I sitting here? One of the things that I often felt during the pandemic, like, I'm losing time, and I felt like I'm missing out. And there was this one time also where my mother was like, you know, falling off the stairs and got something with on her back, right? And at first I thought it was something more severe, so everything is good now. But like, you know, during this time I was like, I'm not there. What if something happens to my parents, right? So I'm just happy to go back and spend some time with them. And like making fun with my brother, right? Like, so that's just like, you know, just doing normal things with them, right? Like, I think that's what I would love to do. Like, just use the time, enjoy the time together with them.
Thank you to Kate Waffle, Ariana Jordan, and Alexander Schaefer for sharing their stories. That's it for today's show. Steve's back tomorrow. He goes hunting for acorns and learning the fine art of making wee-wish, the acorn mush that was central to local Native American diets for centuries. That's tomorrow's Greater LA. Reach out to us on our website. Tell us how you're doing and what you're doing for the holidays. Have big plans? Small ones? You can also give us your feedback on the show. Any questions or comments would be much appreciated. And subscribe to the podcast as well, all at kcrw.com/GLA. Catherine Barnes, Crystal Goss, Sonia Geis, Greg Warna, Phil Richards, Amy Ta, Christian Camito, Holly Adams, and Christian Berdahl all helped put today's episode together. By the way, did you know that James Brown died on Christmas Day way back in 2006? As the holidays get underway this year, we remember the incomparable and eternal Godfather of Soul. I'm Erin Aubrey Kaplan. Thanks for listening, and happy holidays to all.